Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. If I don't sound like myself, I don't sound like myself. I'm recovering from a respiratory illness, and I can assure you I'm not contagious to those of you who are listening. However, I'm not so sure about our guests. Current U.S. statistics suggest that about 8%, about 1 in 10 of us, have asthma. This is a highly variable lung problem that can range in severity to so mild it may be difficult to diagnose to a disabling condition. Professional athletes compete on the highest level with asthma, and yet others have activities severely restricted. Severe life-threatening exacerbations are still too common, even though very safe and effective treatments are available for most people with asthma. Our guests today are Marge Stone King. She's Executive Director of the American Lung Association in Alaska, and Anchorage allergist Dr. Melinda Rathkoff. We'll be discussing this common and often poorly controlled problem of asthma and answering your questions. You can reach us with questions and comments. If you live in Anchorage, our number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We'll be here for about an hour if you have questions or comments about what you hear today. Welcome to both of you. It's nice to have you back.
Thank you. Thank you.
I think we did this less than a year ago or about a year ago.
About a year ago, yeah.
All right. So Marge, the Lung Association, has been involved in lung diseases in Alaska for years. What's the involvement with asthma?
So as a voluntary health agency, we work primarily on the public health level, which means that we work primarily on strategies that affect population-based health versus direct patient care. So in asthma specifically, that looks like policy advocacy for clean air, healthy air, and policies that improve health care, such as Medicaid expansion. And it also looks like research. So we fund a lot of research around the country, and specifically we have an airway clinical research center network all around the country that does clinical trials on asthma and COPD. Then we have some direct patient resources here in Alaska, including an Asthma Basics online program that you can find at lung.org/asthma basics. That's free. And also our free lung helpline, which is staffed by nurses and respiratory therapists. It's a good resource for anyone with kids with asthma, with adults with asthma in the family, or other lung diseases or air quality questions. And it's it can be a good lifeline in between healthcare provider visits.
When you're talking to individuals about asthma, at least my recollection is when I was back working and did some work with the Lung Association, there's people who have been affected directly by asthma, and many of them understand it pretty well, but policymakers often have a very poor understanding. Is that still the case? And this has been over 30 years since I've been doing stuff with asthma in Alaska.
Yeah, I think that's very much still the case. You know, policymakers, first and foremost, are people. So unless they've been affected personally or someone in their family's been affected, then they don't know how serious asthma can be or the way it can affect a person on a daily basis. And they're not generally aware of the costs of asthma care to public health, to the state of Alaska, as well as on the individual level.
Yeah. I mean, anything that's affecting roughly 1 in 10 of us, and with the cost of health care just for an emergency room visit and many of the medications, the cost can mount up to terribly. And then there's the missed work, school, and so forth that has to be taken into account.
Exactly. And I think that's true with any chronic illness, chronic disease. But asthma is especially costly, I think, because it's often so poorly controlled, which lands people in the emergency room, which is, as you say, more expensive than managing your asthma on a daily basis.
It's a tricky illness in certain respects. I'm not sure. That may not be true of a lot of chronic illnesses, but let's see if we can flesh out with Dr. Rathkoff here a little bit about what asthma is and why it may be so difficult to control. So can you paint us a picture of what's happening in asthma with individuals?
I can. So asthma, kind of the basics are it's chronic. It's not a single episode or a single illness. It's recurrent in nature. And generally reversible to some extent. So when you look at the structure of the lungs, you know, our lungs are to promote gas exchange. Our lungs are to take air in, take in oxygen, get it to our blood so it can be delivered to the rest of our bodies and give off CO2. But the anatomy of the lungs, these different air tubes are lined with different types of cells that secrete different things, and they're lined with muscles. What can happen in asthma is that you can actually have thickening and increased numbers of some of these cells. So you get kind of a narrowed pipe. So think of a clogged straw or narrowed pipeway. And then on top of that narrowing, you can have increased mucus production, which can further clog it. And then you can actually have more of a spasm, or what a lot of people think of as a classic asthma attack, where it really constricts down suddenly. But it can be variable, and I think that's probably what you mean by the tricky. So some people feel like they never truly experience an asthma attack, and unfortunately some people experience them almost constantly. Some people can have very mild asthma with only certain triggers. You know, I have some patients who only have asthma during birch season, and they have an allergic type of asthma, and it really only bothers them if the birch level's really high or if they're around cats and they're allergic to cats. Some people have a more intrinsic type of asthma, so it's more triggered by viral infections or exercise, and less so by what's in their environment. So the variability can make it confusing because it can present totally different in different people, even in twins. One mom, you know, the mom may have one type of asthma, a child may have another, but it's the same basic mechanism of reversible airway obstruction that can respond to medications.
And I guess I've always thought it's variable also in the sense that these changes that you describe, the swelling of the airway, the mucus, and the bronchoconstriction that we all know about from advertisements on TV, I guess, is they can be different at different times of the day, different years, days of the year, and so forth. And it doesn't mean that all of the airways, of which there are, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of them, are all affected at the same amount at any one time.
Correct. And even throughout the person's life. When in general, we see a lot of toddlers and infants that will wheeze. And that's been estimated to be as high as about 30% will have some recurrent wheezing. And not all of those kids go on to have true persistent asthma. We're looking at probably about 8 to 10% go on to have more true persistent asthma. So we see a lot of those kids, and trying to help determine who's asthmatic, who's not. A lot of kids will wheeze with viral infections and a lot of irritants in the first few years of life, but generally tend to outgrow that. But we'll often see, if, you know, in real general terms, that boys tend to do worse when they're younger and more the toddler and the school age. And then we see a little bit of a shift, and more around puberty and adulthood, we tend to see girls and women who have a harder time with their asthma. So even in one person's lifetime, what could start as an infant or toddler as a viral induced, they only wheeze or cough when they get a cold, then they may kind of be fairly asymptomatic for a few years, and then they may develop more exercise induced symptoms in the preteen and teen years, and then go on to have more chronic persistent asthma as they get older.
Let me remind listeners just quickly that you're listening to Line One, your health connection, and my guests today are Marge Stone King. She's Executive Director of the American Lung Association in Alaska, and you've just been listening to Anchorage allergist Dr. Melinda Rathkoff. Our topic is asthma. This is a common problem that is still leading to much too much cost and missed work and difficulties in the United States. And we'd encourage you to call and ask questions or make comments. You can reach us at 550-8433. 550-8433, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. One of the things I was hearing you say, which is definitely different than what I was trained over 30 years ago, is that we were often told, as I recall, and your memory's not good, so I may be wrong, but you outgrew asthma, and now we have, you know, 15, 60, maybe even 70-year longitudinal studies where we followed the same group of people for a long time, and that's not what happens.
I'm in the camp that I don't think you truly outgrow asthma, at least not true asthma. Again, I do think there's a population of early wheezers in that infant and toddler stage that were probably not genetically determined to go on and have asthma and will outgrow that, and it's usually by 3 to 5 years of age. Often I'll see kids at that age and go ahead and assess, are there allergies that run in the family? Are there allergies in the child themselves? If they're already allergic to the pet or some pollens, then most likely they're looking at a more persistent pattern. If mom has asthma, that tends to be the other big risk factor, maternal history of asthma. And so we kind of stratify their risk and follow clinically. We'll often treat those children at that infant and toddler stage the same as we do asthmatics, because only time will help us tell if it's going to be persistent or not.
And Marge, again, just asking your experience generally working with the public and people you're trying to get to help on a population basis. Do most people still think that asthma is something that you outgrow, or do they realize that it's something that can appear to be gone for a number of years and then come back again?
No, I think that myth is alive and well, that asthma is more common in childhood and that you outgrow it. And I think there's a huge gap in understanding that actually adults can get adult onset asthma. Mm. And the other thing, you know, people tend to be surprised about is if they develop asthma and they don't have asthma in their family. So we know that genetics are a component, but they're not the only determining factor, right?
Correct. And I often will ask about a history of viral infections as an infant and toddler, and especially RSV seems to be a unique virus that's very common in infant and toddlers, and in children who tend to have a worse RSV course, wheeze with it, or if they're hospitalized, tend to go on to have more persistent recurrent symptoms. And an interesting study tried to determine, is it children who have RSV go on to develop asthma, or is it children that are genetically predisposed to have asthma just have worse RSV? And the outcome of that single study, at least, tended to be more kids who are genetically predisposed to asthma just have a worse outcome from their RSV.
And that argument's been around for a long time, and the one that bothers me is, if that was true, is that RSV causes asthma, since all children have asthma. I mean, I have RSV in the first couple of years, and all of us ought to have asthma. So, complex issue, and sometimes difficult to answer simple questions. So here's a good question. This is a deep one from one of our regular listeners. I've recently read Dr. Martin Blaser in a book called Missing Microbes, that the use of antibiotics during the first 3 years of life is associated with an increased risk of asthma and may help explain the increase in incidence of the disease over the last couple of decades. Could you talk about how our microbiome may play into asthma or explain the mechanisms behind the association? And you better explain microbiome for listeners.
That is a big question. So, you know, there's been the hygiene hypothesis is kind of a term that's been around for a while, of looking at why allergic disease in general. So I'm really going to kind of relate the asthma to allergic asthma and this to ATP or allergy in general. But one of the reasons we think we've seen an increase in allergic diseases across the board, including asthma, is this hygiene hypothesis that we're much cleaner than our immune system was designed for us to be. We're born in sterile environments. We take antibiotics much more frequently. We use hand sanitizer all the time. We don't let our kids eat food and stuff that falls on the ground. We discourage them. So we kind of take away some of the function of our immune system, and it's thought to, then we start responding to things that our immune system was meant to tolerate and determine, you know, whether something is dangerous or not. And it's kind of lost some of that balance. And there are, multiple studies now to suggest that children born in farming environments, children born to families with a lot of older siblings, where there are more germs, there's more microbes, more exposure to endotoxins specifically is something that comes from bacteria and germs that has been shown to correlate, that with less exposure to that tend to have more allergies, but more exposure to that can be protective. So children born in farming communities and larger families, the younger children tend to have less allergic disease than similar groups of children born in a more urban environment or in smaller families. So just this thought that we've kind of altered the function of our immune system. And I tell people it's not a poor immune system. It's an immune system looking for something to do.
And antibiotics then can somehow get into this conversation?
Yeah, sorry. So antibiotics are part of altering that. Instead of our immune system getting the chance to fight off some of these, and I'm not saying don't take antibiotics when they're indicated by your doctor, but I think we'd all agree, even as a physician, of overprescription of antibiotics and probably taking them more than are necessary in a general sense. So overuse, again, we're killing the good bacteria along with the bad bacteria when we take antibiotics. So if you wipe out your good bacteria, i.e. your microbiome, you're causing some of that imbalance.
And so one of the mechanisms may be that I've read about is that when you get rid of some of those microorganisms, the microbiome, they're actually important in educating our immune system as to what's good to respond to and what's not to.
Good. Yes. So like self versus non-self. We have self bacteria. We're all colonized and we have good bacteria. And that's kind of the whole probiotic revolution that we've seen is trying to replace some of that. But we naturally have these bacteria in us, and they're meant to do good. And we've all seen examples of that, that you get some other infections after taking antibiotics. But overuse, we think, definitely leads to an imbalance of that microbiome of the good versus the bad organisms that we naturally have. It's been looked at with children born by cesarean section versus vaginally. Those born vaginally have different organisms that are in their microbiome and their gut flora that are thought to be protective. So it's a very delicate balance, and there's so many factors that can throw that off. And therefore, that slight alteration in your immune system, especially in someone who's got some genetic risk factors, it's not a simple genetic disease where you have the gene defect, you have the disease, but there are definitely genetic defects that are associated with asthma, and then these environmental influences can bring it out.
And with regard to asthma, that's just one theory, right? So we know that asthma rates have been increasing for the last three decades, but we don't know why. So that's one theory. Another theory would be that we've just gotten better at diagnosing it. So there are that many more people diagnosed. So we know asthma is on the rise. We don't know why.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably
we also
some
don't
of
know
both.
How to cure it, yeah. But we know how to manage it.
Right.
And it's probably some of both. I think
probably,
there's definitely
yeah.
better diagnosis. And maybe in some cases overdiagnosis, but I would say that's less so. I think it's better diagnosis, better recognition, because we have better treatments. But it's probably some of both. Even when they've tried to control for those factors, there is probably a true increase, but there's also better recognition.
And I'm going to maybe throw in another ringer about this complexity, is that there are those who think that it's not just one disorder.
Yeah.
That some people have allergies. And as you mentioned earlier, that people may not have caught, there are people who have asthma who don't have allergies. And as we understand what's going on in the lungs on the microscopic and submicroscopic level, it turns out there's different things going on in different people's lungs that are hard to explain in one overlying mechanism.
Definitely. So I see some people who it is strictly viral-induced asthma. They only get it when they get a cold. They don't get it with exercise. They are not allergic. See some, again, like birch season, they have asthma for 2 or 3 months out of the year. But while they have it, it acts like asthma. It looks like asthma. It responds to asthma treatment. And the basic mechanism is the same. You can have asthma from having some type of exposure, pollutant, a gas, a noxious exposure that causes some damage. Can cause some asthma symptoms. So there are a lot of variability in the disease and even within an individual person. So as we get more sophisticated with our genetic testing, with our in-office testing even, we may be able to further delineate that. We already know. We see it. We see it in our patients, and you see it in your children, your spouse, yourself, that some people respond better to some medications and not others. There's been multiple studies looking at different types of asthma medications and why some people do really well on one type versus another. And we know that's related a lot to the genetics of the disease in that person.
All right. Madison, you're on line one with another issue that may make asthma more confusing, it sounds like to me. What's your question? Hello, Madison?
Hello?
Yeah, what can we do for you?
Hi. Could you talk about asthma and vocal cord dysfunction, like those two being interlinked?
You betcha. Good question. That's what makes asthma even more complex.
Definitely, yeah.
So vocal cord dysfunction is, I try to think of it kind of as a spasm of the muscles around the vocal cords and the vocal cords themselves that can make it, can kind of mimic an asthma attack. You can have a sudden onset of trouble breathing. So often it's diagnosed with asthma, but about 40% of the time it can coexist with asthma. The main clinical differences I'll try to ask patients about is, do you have a harder time when you're having your symptoms breathing in and taking a deep breath, or do you have a harder time breathing out and blowing your air out? Unless your asthma is real severe, in general, think of asthma is disease down in the airways in your lung itself, and air gets trapped, and you have a hard time getting that air out. You'll often cough or wheeze worse on expiration or when you're blowing the air out. With vocal cord dysfunction, it's above the level of your lungs, and actually you tend to feel it more in the throat area, and it's trouble getting air in. It's trouble taking a deep breath. So I'll ask people to try to think of that difference when they're actually having their symptoms. Is it breathing in versus breathing out? And does albuterol help? Do asthma medicines help? In general, they don't tend to help vocal cord dysfunction. Relaxation or getting away from the stimulus, getting hydrated can all help with vocal cord. Whereas the albuterol may not help as much, whereas true asthma, the albuterol is a very good medication and it should help. But again, they can often coexist, and I definitely have patients who have both. So learning to recognize the difference, and there are tools we have in the office at diagnosis that we can use to try to help delineate the two.
Did that help, Madison?
Yeah, definitely. It was very. I've been diagnosed with vocal cord dysfunction and asthma, so I was wondering what you have to say about it.
Right. It's one of those things that's probably terribly underdiagnosed and overdiagnosed as asthma when it's not asthma. So I guess we think about it a lot in people who are not responding to asthma medications. That's a big clue. And then, you know, in people with asthma, they're getting worse despite good medications. Those are classic situations. And I would say my experience, at least dealing with teenagers with asthma, is it's something that suddenly causes you to have trouble breathing with exercise is rarely asthma. Asthma can cause rapid onset. But when you talk to lots of people with asthma, that's not the way asthma hits them. And this can be extremely frightening, leads people to the emergency room, and all kinds of crazy things that happen once you get there.
I would agree. Often I'll ask about that. If the symptoms start within the first few minutes of exercise and you feel that sudden onset, that's less likely to be your asthma. Exercise-induced asthma tends to take a little bit longer onset and actually often peaks when you're done with the exercise, whereas vocal cord dysfunction tends to come on quickly and relieve itself fairly quickly.
All right, Madison, thanks for the call. Hope that helped everybody.
Okay, yeah, no problem.
All right.
Thank you for answering it.
You bet. Have a good day. Another question that's come in is, please discuss the relationship of prescription drugs needed for chronic conditions and for asthma. Often the side effects of these medications, the prescription drugs, mention asthma as a side effect. How do we know that if we actually suffer from asthma, or is it the drugs that have triggered something that may look like asthma or may be causing asthma? Or does it matter? And the result is that we must use the inhaler. So somebody's confused here about hearing so much on TV, unfortunately, about medications may trigger asthma.
So I can try to divide asthma medications into two very broad categories. You have controller medications, and then you have reliever medications. So when people think of asthma and asthma attacks and reaching for their inhaler, they're usually thinking of a reliever, the most common of which is albuterol. There's some varieties out there. There are other reliever medications, but that's the main one that people think of. And that's used when needed for acute symptoms, sudden onset of symptoms, at least those that aren't related to vocal cord dysfunction, as we just discussed. But then in someone who has symptoms fairly commonly, we generally talk about more than a couple times a week of needing to use their rescue inhaler, waking up at night more than a few times a month, or ending up in the emergency room or with a severe flare-up more than a couple times a year, we tend to ask those people to start what we call controller medications. The idea being, take this medicine every day to prevent your asthma attack and to prevent the inflammation going on in your lungs. So I'm not sure exactly which medicine you're asking about that can cause asthma. You know, medicines do have, most of the inhalers do have some propellants, preservatives in it. And I do know some patients who have had a little bit of bronchospasm or feel a little bit almost of an asthma type attack from them. But that tends to be a very quick, almost irritant type reaction. And much of that can actually be involving the vocal cords, as we already talked about. Most of them, though, don't tend to cause a true asthma-like attack in the lower airways.
Some heart medicines can increase the likelihood of bronchospasm. That's the one that maybe they're talking about here.
So there is a class of medication called a beta blocker. They're used for hypertension, so for high blood pressure, and they can often be used in other people as a migraine prophylaxis medicine. And they do have a risk factor associated of increased bronchospasm, whether you have a diagnosis of asthma or not. So in someone who does have a diagnosis of asthma, definitely talk to your provider if they do prescribe a beta blocker, because that's something you want to decide, the risk-benefit ratio. What is the beta blocker being used for? Are there other medications that would not have the asthma-type side effects that could be used instead?
There's another reason why many of the public who has particularly watched TV may think that medicines cause asthma, and that's the FDA requirement that if you're going to market a product, that you have to report any side effects that occurred with this large group of people being tested for this medication that may occur during the time they are taking the medication. Doesn't mean cause and effect, and any problem that's 10% of the population, almost every medication may be associated with asthma-like symptoms, even though they don't have anything to do with asthma. And I think there's a terrible misunderstanding in general, and maybe more harm than good done from some of the way the FDA requires or is asking companies to substantiate and tell people their risks of medications. It gets way overdone. Anyway, all right, so we're close to halfway through. We have somebody holding on the phone right now, a couple of other calls or emails. I want to get back to those, but let me take our break right now. Remind everybody you're listening to Line 1, your health connection, our local number 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. After this very short break, we'll continue our discussion of asthma with Marge Stone King and Dr. Melinda Rathkoff. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, we're discussing asthma, which is a common but highly variable illness that is unfortunately still causing lots of deaths, unfortunately, and too much expense in this country, despite the fact that its safe and effective treatment is widely available. Our guests are Marge Stone King, Executive Director of the Alaska Lung Association, the American Lung Association in Alaska, and Anchorage allergist Dr. Melinda Rathkoff. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local phone number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Next, let's take one more phone call. Stan, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, hi. You've referred to exercise-induced asthma a couple times, and I'm very interested in that. I could just quickly tell you my experience. A little over a year ago, in winter conditions, I rode my bike several miles to a school gymnasium, played an hour or so of pickleball, and then on my way home, developed some chest discomfort that was pretty unusual for me. Since I'm a 65-year-old male, my family and friends, of course, encouraged me to go to the emergency room, and we did a complete cardiac workup, and the cardiologist said he didn't think my symptoms were caused by heart issues. So as near as I can tell, this must have been exercise-induced asthma. I'd just be interested in comments.
I'm going to let Melinda address that, but the first question I'm pretty sure she's going to ask, you ever had a history of asthma?
No.
Mm. When you were younger, did you have a lot of bronchitis, a lot of pneumonia?
No. I've been very healthy throughout my life, quite active and quite healthy.
All right, we'll give it. I'll give it to the expert here.
So I should probably have corrected myself from using the term exercise-induced asthma. The preferred term these days, when it's purely exercise-induced, is exercise-induced bronchospasm. And I think they want the point that you don't have to have an underlying diagnosis of asthma or pre-existing asthma to have exercise-induced symptoms. And you paint a pretty good example of the risk factors, which are exercise, so the strenuous activity, and then cold and dry. So when we look at exercise-induced bronchospasm and what's different with it, it seems to be a difference as the air that we breathe in tries to warm itself up and humidify itself before entering our airways tends to cause this bronchospasm. And it's not uncommon to see this in someone without an underlying asthma diagnosis or asthma history, even though that was my first question, because we definitely see exercise-induced symptoms in people who have pre-existing asthma. But you can have pure exercise-induced bronchospasm, and it tends to be cold and dry air. So I imagine the extent of the exercise you did with the bike ride there, the game, the activity at the gym, and then riding the bike back in the winter is probably what produced it. So ways to help prevent it are to not be as strenuous when you're in that environment, when you're out in the cold and in the dry, is to cover your mouth with a gaiter or a scarf. So, you know, we've all worn those when it's cold, and you know it warms up the air and it humidifies the air. So the air you're breathing in is warmer and more humid. And also just staying hydrated in general. You know, if you didn't drink in between those episodes, you were probably getting dehydrated, and that dryness, you know, shows up in your airways too. So you could have had just a true exercise-induced bronchospasm without knowing, you know, further history or genetics or your risk. You know, don't know what your risk will be. Could it happen again? Was it a one-time thing? Was there also some irritants? You know, had they laid some recent gravel on the road? Did you have a mild cold at the time? There's other cofactors that could have brought this episode out, even though you're in general a very active person and never had anything like this. But it can occur, and you paint a pretty classic picture of a situation where that can occur.
Okay. So, but likely this was just a one-time episode. That if I, what you say really makes sense to me, because the more I cover my mouth and when I'm doing strenuous work or exercise, that really does help.
And I think it's possible that if you pushed yourself to that extent, that hydration level or lack of hydration in that cold and dryness, that it could happen again. But, you know, we're not sure how much of each of those factors did it take to bring it out this time. Where is your trigger point? So just making sure you're hydrated, that you're covering your mouth and you're warming up and humidifying that air when you breathe it in when you're out in the situation. I don't think you necessarily have to limit yourself otherwise. But definitely pay attention for anything else. And if that pattern changes, follow up with your provider.
Yeah. Thank you.
Stan, did you cough during that episode?
I did cough a little, as I remember. Mostly I could not take a deep breath.
In or out?
In.
Yeah. So another possibility is what we were talking about earlier, is this was more of some vocal cord dysfunction, which could be triggered by the same processes. And asthma is usually associated with cough. It usually is an expiratory, high-pitched wheeze, which is easier for me to do right now because my trachea is smaller. Whereas vocal cord dysfunction is more something where you're having trouble getting air in. And maybe you'll also feel more tightness in your neck versus a feeling of someone standing on your chest or something with asthma.
Yes, I agree. The neck tightness is a symptom.
Yeah. So this doesn't sound like asthma. I think we're both shaking our heads. And doesn't make much sense that asthma medications would help you. if it were to continue to happen, call Dr. Rathkoff's office because they can fix it. without medicines, we want to keep you busy, okay? All right. Thanks for your call. A similar question came from someone who has emailed in that when they're biking in the winter, they notice they may have to have trouble with their asthma and use their inhaler. And wanted to know if there were other suggestions. And you mentioned a couple about trying to humidify or protect your airway from cold, dry air with some covering and so forth. But hard to do sometimes.
It is. And it sounds like this this caller may already have underlying asthma and has asthma medicine. So making sure your asthma is well controlled. We often will see people whose asthma is not optimally controlled, but they don't push themselves on a regular basis. And it's only when they push themselves that they notice symptoms. So make sure your baseline asthma is controlled. And if you're having an asthma flare-up, that's not the time to go bike riding in the winter or skiing or exert yourself. And I agree with Dr. Woodard that vocal cord dysfunction can present very similarly and be hard to differentiate at a single episode. So making sure you follow up for that and seeing what can be going on. But if you have underlying asthma, I think the number one thing is to make sure your asthma is well controlled before you exercise. Some patients are instructed to use an inhaler before exercise to help prevent an asthma attack, and that can be helpful in stopping the exercise-induced asthma attack like we talked about. And then the vocal cord dysfunction, if that's playing a role, again, staying well hydrated and warming that air up.
Yeah, and because you need to use the albuterol before exercise doesn't necessarily mean that your asthma is poorly controlled every time. That can be part of your management. I don't want people to think because they have asthma that they can't be active outdoors or outdoors in the winter time, because that's not the case.
Agree.
And some people misinterpret. I've had people think that because they need that inhaler, because they have asthma, it's the inhaler that's causing the asthma. I can understand how they think that, but there's no evidence to suggest that if you use albuterol a lot that causes asthma. There's some evidence it may decrease the ability of that medicine to work as well.
Yeah, I think it's important for people to understand how safe asthma medications
These
are.
These are legal to use in the Olympic Games is how I try to sell it to people. You have to jump through some hoops to prove you really have asthma, but they're pretty safe medications.
And by the way, winter Olympians tend to have more asthma because they're pushing their lungs outdoors in that cold, dry air that we just talked about,
And we have a lot of good treatments now for asthma. So, you know, if you've tried medicines in the past and didn't tolerate it or feel you failed them, don't limit yourself because of your asthma. Seek follow-up and seek advice on alternative treatments that may be available, because there's a lot of options to choose from. It's not a one-size-fits-all. And don't limit yourself as a way of preventing asthma. That's not the best way. The best way is to seek treatment. And that doesn't necessarily always mean medication. Don't be scared that if you come in, you're automatically going to end up on multiple medications. We take a lot of things into account and try to recommend a treatment plan that involves more than just medications.
So we've thrown around this term asthma management, but maybe we should talk more specifically about what that is and how that varies from person to person.
Okay.
Do you want to start?
So when we talk about an asthma management plan, you know, identification and correct diagnosis is key. So following up with your provider, finding out what your triggers are. And your triggers, again, may be viral infections, it may be exercise, the cold air, but it may be allergic. When you look at children with asthma, as high as 90% have allergic triggers, and that's the reason Dr. Woodard asked an allergist to do this talk today. But even in adults, 50 to 60% can have allergic triggers. So knowing what those triggers are and trying to avoid them. So the key for asthma is avoidance of triggers, treatment of other comorbid conditions. So what I mean by that, in someone who has maybe gastroesophageal reflux, chronic sinusitis, or other diseases that can hurt their asthma. Medications, like we talked about beta blocker medications earlier. So getting help in multiple treatment plans on things to avoid, things, diet and exercise. There are definitely things in the diet that have been shown to help. Being at a healthy weight and a healthy activity level can help. And then medications are to add and supplement when the other things can't completely control your asthma, and to have as that backup when you have a true asthma attack. So everyone needs an asthma management plan. I think we're really good at doing this for our school school-aged children because the schools have adopted it and we're really good about filling those out. I think we're not as good about doing it in the younger age kids or the adults, but everyone really needs a good asthma management plan. And that's where a lot of the resources out there with the Lung Association, with AFA Alaska and other resources can really help with that.
Yeah, so part of that asthma management plan is knowing how to monitor your own asthma by using a peak flow meter, which can actually predict whether or not you're likely to have an asthma attack that day. So peak flow meter, you establish what your baseline level is in terms of the expiratory output of your lungs, with the air you blow out, what's your baseline, and then if that baseline is reading low on a given day, that might be a day for you to stay indoors because the air is bad outside. It might be a day for you to take your rescue inhaler before you do exercise, or it might be a day to call your health care provider.
A very simple equipment that can really give you objective information about how your lungs are doing and not have to depend on feeling of whether or not you're having trouble. That can fool people. It's been well documented.
Yeah.
Diane, you're on line one.
Hi.
Howdy.
Hi. I want to talk about old people's lungs. When you get older, of course, we know that lungs don't expand. more rigid. And especially if you've had, some accidents, and maybe some broken ribs. How do you differentiate between asthma, when you're breathing heavy, when you're trying to walk up the hill, versus, something that contributed to old age? And
right.
What do you do about it?
Yeah. How do you know you're just not out of shape? Or how do you know? And good question.
So we actually have some really good tools. And when you look at lung function starts out low, increases as we get older, but really peaks in our mid-20s and then slowly declines. I like to draw this graph for my patients, especially the teenagers, and show them the reasons that they don't want to smoke. It'll definitely bring that curve down quicker and faster. But there are other things that can bring it down too, lung injury and other issues. But when we look at lung function and try to test your lung function in a clinical setting, we actually do compare it to what's expected based on your gender, your ethnicity, your height, and your age. So we do correct it for age because it's expected, as we know, all of our lung function declines over time. You mentioned fibrosis and restriction. We can pick that up on the lung testing. We can tell if the symptoms are due to what we call obstruction, which asthma is an obstructive lung disease. There's obstruction in the airways, in the pipes, versus restriction, which is something outside the lungs. You mentioned like a broken rib, some muscular disease, musculoskeletal issues, fibrosis of the lungs themselves. So we can tell the difference with pulmonary function testing, spirometry testing, even what's available just in the office setting. So there are some helpful tools that we can use, and we do take age and your individual history into consideration when looking at that.
And so, would, say, rescue inhalers, albuterol, help even if you don't have asthma, but you've got all these other issues?
Well, I'd be hesitant to say yes. They may help some, but you really want to make sure you've looked for the other underlying issues. It's not uncommon for there to be something else going on that gets blamed on asthma, especially in asthmatics, that gets blamed on their asthma. And Dr. Woodard talked about we look at vocal cord dysfunction when your asthma is not responding. And as a provider, we all have these lists in our heads, and that, when your asthma is not acting like asthma should and it's not responding to the asthma medicines, because there's some really good asthma medicines out there, then we take a step back and say, okay, what else is going on? Because even someone with asthma can have something else. So yes, asthma inhalers can help, but if you don't truly have asthma, we need to figure out what you do have and why you're having the symptoms. And in someone who does have asthma, but as their lungs age, they may not get the response to the asthma medications quite as optimal as they did. You may not get that full reversibility. Chronic asthma, especially if it's undertreated or untreated, can lead to what we call fixed airway disease, where that reversibility becomes fixed over time and is less and less reversible.
Okay, thank you. I hope you have this program on again and continue the discussion.
All right, well, and anytime you want to listen, you can go to alaskapublic.org, find the Line 1 connection, and you can listen to the pro program again. Thanks for your call, Robin. Or Diane, it was. I'm sorry. Robin, you're on Line 1. What can we do for you?
Yes. My mom did exercise. She was cross-country skiing when it was really cold last year. And then she started coughing for 2 months. And my dad finally said, go to the doctor. So she got diagnosed with induced asthma by exercise. And so they gave her an inhaler. And so that helped a lot. She had inflammation in her lungs. And so she used the inhaler. But then after that kind of cooled off and she stopped using the inhaler, she noticed she lost her sense of smell. So she has not been using the nasal inhaler now since last year because she doesn't have any more symptoms about the asthma. Mm-hmm. But she has no smell. So I just I'd like you to comment on that.
Yeah, that's a good question. Let's see what Dr. Rathkoff says.
So just to clarify, you said was she using a nasal spray? You said a nasal inhaler. Was she using an inhaler over her mouth for the albuterol?
Nasal inhaler.
Okay. So for a nasal spray, you know, you'd want to know I'm wondering, generally we treat asthma with inhalers that you take in through your mouth and get into your lungs. You try not to swallow it, but you try to breathe it in through the mouth. We don't we don't treat asthma generally with nasal inhalers or nasal sprays. Often, though, if it's thought you have coexisting sinus disease or allergic rhinitis, also known as hay fever, which has nasal inflammation, she may have gotten treatment for both, and the nasal spray may be treating more the upper airway disease when generally an inhaler is taken by mouth to treat the lower airway. If someone saw that something that they thought she needed a nasal spray for and now she's having trouble smelling, I'd recommend follow-up. There are certain sinus and nasal conditions that can compress on the nasal nerves. You can have nasal polyps. You could have chronic sinusitis. There may be something that's been overlooked or something that's developed since her last follow-up if she doesn't have the ability to smell. It'd be unusual for asthma to be treated through a nasal spray and to cause a lack of ability to smell at this point.
Okay, well, that was my question, is that common or is that maybe another underlying problem?
Yeah, let me put it more succinctly than Dr. Rathkoff. I think anything's possible. The likelihood that an inhaler in your nose or your lungs caused your mother to lose her smell is not high. Allergies, sinus disease, other illnesses, other problems could easily or much more likely to have caused the loss of smell, and just coincidental that the nasal spray or an asthma inhaler were being used. I think that's much more likely.
Also, just an interesting thing, she can still taste.
Yep.
So isn't smell and taste usually related? So
yep.
It's kind of a mystery.
Yep, they are related, but you can taste without much of a smell.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate your comments, and I always listen to your program. I so appreciate all your knowledge and information. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. What I wrote down here is we never did talk about the symptoms of asthma, and one of the things I had bold to ask about, what is the most common symptom of asthma?
So I'll see if Dr. Woodard agrees with me. I would say cough.
Uh-huh.
Is the most common. People talk about wheezing, and wheezing is more specific for asthma. There's a lot of other things that can cause cough. There's other things that can cause wheezing. So we tend to ask about wheezing, but cough, especially in children, is the most common symptom. And there's some diagnoses of cough variant asthma or cough type asthma, but in asthma, cough is by far the most common symptom. And we'll often see, I'll ask about, does every cold go to the chest? Is every cold worse in this child than your other children? Does every cold cause a cough that lasts and lingers longer than everyone else's? Those are all kind of some red flag questions to think about a diagnosis of asthma. So do you agree, Dr. Woodard, cough?
Yeah, I would say the most common is recurrent cough. I go a little bit further. Usually productive cough, not a dry, hacky cough either, like I have right now.
So does everyone who has these symptoms need to go see a specialist, or can they talk to their family physician about these?
I would start with your primary care provider, because there's a lot in the differential. Obviously, as an allergist and asthma specialist, I see the population that the primary care provider truly thought had asthma and sent my way, or has allergies and is at risk of asthma, because having allergies does put you at risk of asthma. You're much more likely to develop asthma if you had food allergies, eczema, or environmental allergies at a younger age. But definitely start with your primary care provider. Most are definitely aware of asthma, and most treat asthma. We tend to see the people who have chronic recurrent issues, lack of control, or again, to look for those triggers and help out with trigger control.
So every general practitioner, family practitioner, pediatrician can diagnose asthma, and we've heard a lot about you asking questions and about history and symptoms and that kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit about spirometry and that role in diagnosis?
I'm a big advocate of spirometry. So spirometry is a type of lung function test that looks at blowing out air. How fast can you blow it out? How much can you get out? And then breathing back in. It's very helpful in a lot of the things we've talked about so far, looking at asthma versus vocal cord dysfunction, looking at asthma or obstructive lung disease versus restrictive lung disease. And I find it to be a very helpful tool. It is recommended in the most recent guidelines put out by the NIH, by the U.S. government on asthma care, that spirometry be used as a tool for caring for patients with asthma, not just when they're sick, but when they're well. And I do think it is catching on. I do see more and more pediatric offices and more family practitioners and other healthcare providers starting to utilize it. It may not be in all of primary care yet because people weren't necessarily trained to use it and how to use it. And we tend to do the things we were trained to do. As an asthma specialist, I was obviously trained on spirometry, so find it to be a helpful tool. I would defer to Dr. Woodard for his comments as a general pediatrician and primary care provider on the use of spirometry.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely helpful. What was I going to say? I've lost where I was. The diagnosis of asthma is not difficult to make if you've seen enough, but I mean it's an objective measurement, which is, and I guess what I was going to say is that asthma is a problem where we get a lot of subjective information from patients about how they feel and what helps and so forth and what triggers it. And it's been shown that an objective measure, such as spirometry, really does correct the diagnosis sometimes, and it does lead to understanding how well control is in particular. And so it's one of those problems where both subjective and objective information are very helpful because there's not absolutely one perfect test.
Agree. And I'm not saying you have to do spirometry to make the diagnosis. I've diagnosed plenty of asthma without using it, but it can be very helpful in those who aren't acting, their asthma's not acting like asthma should act, or you think there is vocal cord dysfunction, you think there's something else going on. It can be a very helpful tool.
Another thing that, Marge, I thought you were going to lead us to when you talked about peak flow meters is monitoring how asthma is, and there's a very well validated 5-question process called the asthma control test that really gets at the basic questions of how well asthma's controlled, not a diagnosis, but how well are you at risk of having problems. Anybody want to talk about that one?
I think you should talk about that one.
There's 5 questions. Basically, it's asking how often is it interfering with your sleep? How often is it you having to use waking up at night with medication? How much does it interfere with activity and so forth? And how do you rate your control? And you have 5 questions with 5 answers. So you got, or was it 5 times 5? 25 is a maximum. And so once you do that, anything 19 or greater generally says you're in pretty good control. Statistically, you're less likely to have problems. And I think this gets to this idea of asthma exacerbations, which I didn't ask about, but it's not that asthma usually suddenly just gets you in trouble. Usually you're slowly losing control over time. You're waking up more at night. You're having to use your albuterol more. You're having less and less exercise. And then suddenly something else happens and now you're in real trouble. But it's been coming on for a long time. Mm-hmm. And if you're just asking yourself or measuring those 5 questions, generally you're not going to get into those kind of situations.
And at that point,
preventative medications, which are extremely safe and extremely helpful in preventing these kinds of bad situations from occurring.
Yeah. And when the bad situations occur, then it takes time for your lungs to heal. You need to see your healthcare provider and get some more heavy duty medications for a short term.
And I find the asthma control test very useful, and actually I give it to all of my asthmatic patients, whether they're there because they're sick or they're there for routine follow-up. Because in general, if you ask someone how they feel, you're going to get the answer any of you who have teenagers get. I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm doing fine. But then when you actually break it down and say, well, how often are you waking up at night? How many times during the day are you, or how many days in a week, in a month, are you needing to use your rescue inhaler? How many times are you having symptoms even if you don't reach for the rescue inhaler? And I think when people stop and think about it, maybe they aren't quite as fine as they think they are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. A huge misconception that's still happening is the albuterol inhalers are going to make it more likely for you to have problems with asthma, when it's actually the other way around. The more you're needing your asthma inhaler, the more likely you are you're going to get into trouble. I try to tell parents or patients that it's albuterol is a little bit like pain medication. You take your pain medication, you feel better. But if you keep needing it, it's telling you something needs to be addressed. And if you need more and more and more albuterol, yeah, you're more likely to end up in the hospital or the emergency room, but it's not necessarily the medication that's causing that. It's the disease process with increasing swelling, difficulty getting the medication into your airways now that they're tighter and full of mucus. That's far and away seems much more likely, and it's a much more dangerous situation. So needing more albuterol is an indication of danger that your asthma is out of control.
It's a good reason to seek help, whether it's with your primary care provider or your asthma specialist.
All right, we're into our last couple of minutes. It's become a habit for me to ask people that are guests, what do we want people, the listeners, to take away from the program, given that the fact that most of us are not going to remember most of what we heard today. We want to come away with a couple very important ideas that maybe makes sense to us that can keep us from having problems, in this case with asthma. Who wants to start?
I would say realize that asthma is a chronic disease. True asthma just doesn't go away so easily. The symptoms, the flare-up can, but that we have really good treatments available. You know, having your grandmother who had asthma that was uncontrolled doesn't mean we can't control yours. So don't be afraid to seek treatment. But once your asthma is controlled, that doesn't mean you can stop your medication. Asthma medications have one of the lowest compliance rates of any medication, and that's what gets you into trouble. When you're feeling better, it doesn't mean you can stop the medications. Talk to your provider. Talk about your asthma care plan and how to best manage your asthma. We often see people do really well, respond really well to their asthma medications, and then they stop taking them and get back into trouble. So don't be afraid of your asthma medications. Talk to your provider. We have really good treatments available.
And I would say that asthma affects adults as well as children, and that you can develop asthma as an adult. And the more you learn about it once you have it or have someone in your family with it, the better you can be a partner with your healthcare provider in managing and monitoring your own asthma. And 1-800-LUNG-USA is the lung helpline that's free to use in between your visits if you have specific questions or need a doctor referral or anything like that.
And if it's not acting like your asthma should and it's not responding to your medications, follow up, because maybe it's not asthma or not just asthma.
Okay. Yeah, this is one that gets us in trouble, and if you're not getting better, you need to be getting to someone to help you figure out why. And if you're needing albuterol, your rescue inhaler more and more, it's a prime indication that you're heading for trouble. Not always. Sometimes you can get away and get away scot-free, but other times it's going to get you into real trouble, and that's one of the things that we need to all recognize.
And people actually die from asthma.
Unfortunately, that's
every
still
day.
The case.
Every
yep.
day.
Getting better. I think the last episode evidence I've seen is a little less frequently than it used to be, but it's still there. All right. My thanks to Marge Stone King and Dr. Melinda Rathkos. If you'd like to continue this conversation about asthma, you can join KSK on Facebook. You can find the link to that on our website, www.alaskapublic.org, where you'll also find our Line 1 archives. You can also let us know your thoughts and suggestions at our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Next week, we're going to enter the realm of adolescent health in a big way with eating disorders, particularly anorexia, bulimia, binge eating, that all have significant health consequences as well. So our guest is Dr. Ellen Rome. She's of the Cleveland Clinic Children's Hospital. And it would be nice if you joined us and try to learn more about your health next Monday, May 18th at 2 p.m. Pat Yak is our chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and audio engineer today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.